This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Here to give us the big picture is A. Whitney Brown. Brown delivers his political commentaries, called The Big Picture, on Weekend Update, Saturday Night Live's cynical comic twist on the news. He's been delivering his commentaries on Saturday Night Live for the past 5 years. They're collected in his new book, The Big Picture. I asked A. Whitney Brown to read his commentary, The Education President.
Friends, we live in a nation of 25 million illiterates. I read that in USA Today. Well, I didn't actually read it, but there was a chart with a stick figure with a diploma hat on pointing to a pie with black and blue and black pieces missing out of it. But that's a scary thought. 1 out of 10 adult Americans can't even read USA Today. What are they all going to do in life? Well, they can't all write for it. Maybe they can dictate the editorials. Maybe they can color in the weather map on the back. You see, other countries, they have programs. Japan, the few illiterate individuals are put to work translating VCR instructions into English. But here, opportunities are limited. Now, I like to read, but I'm not one to push my preferences on others. Rather than campaign fruitlessly against the evils of illiteracy, I got a job writing for television. You know, this spring, I found myself sitting in a restaurant watching a party of young people celebrating. I soon realized they were members of the New York City high school graduating class of 1990, part of that elite 48% of New Yorkers that made it all the way through the system. They were celebrating their unbounded future by dining at Denny's, a restaurant chosen for its use of pictures on the menu. And as I watched them pointing to their selections and puzzling over the arithmetic in a futile attempt to calculate who owed what for the patty melt, it struck me that far too many will face the future ill-equipped to tackle the intricacies of TV Guide in this age of cable. It was their bad luck to go through school before the education president was elected. But you see, it's all a matter of priorities. If they didn't get much out of our shabby, run-down, under-financed old school system, maybe they'll do a little bit better in our brand-new billion-dollar prison program. Either way, I'm sure the education president is concerned about every illiterate one of them. Not as concerned as he'd be if they had an abortion or burned the flag, but he cares.
That's A. Whitney Brown reading from his new book, The Big Picture, and welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's nice to be here, Tracy.
Terry.
I mean, Terry.
But we're old pals.
Yeah.
That no one in the audience should be fooled by that little slip.
Yeah. All right. Well, Terry, if that is your real name.
How did you feel about translating the things that you do on Saturday Night Live into a book?
I felt the greatest feeling of freedom that I've had since for quite a while. It's wonderful to be able to take more than 89 seconds to explain your point of view.
Do you find doing political comedy that there's a problem with audiences who don't follow the newspapers and don't necessarily know what you're talking about?
I find that a lot of people are actively screen out current events. I remember one time, this was a few years ago, I was talking about the ABM treaty. And the information that ABM stands for anti-ballistic missile and that we have a treaty preventing the development of those has been given to every single American probably 100 times since Kennedy signed that treaty. And for someone not to know it, they have to be actively screening it out. And so it's a matter of interest. They screen it out like they do commercials because they don't think they can understand it. So what I try to do is give people the information that they need to understand the joke in the preceding joke. And on top of making them able to laugh at it, since they're not really aware they're getting that information or being reminded of it, it also makes them feel very intelligent when they suddenly find they understand the joke. And that's a good way to make friends.
Let me ask you to update the reading that you did for us. Do you have any impressions on George Bush's recently unveiled education policy?
Well, I think it's inevitable now what he did, you know, after I think it springs directly from the war in Iraq, because we realized that we won the war because we have the smartest bombs in the world. Unfortunately, our bombs are smarter than our average high school graduates. At least the bombs can find Kuwait. You know, and of course, I think after the war, they realize they've reached the limit of that technology because it stands to reason if they make the bombs any smarter, they're going to have second thoughts about war itself. And then you'll be right back where you started from, having to fight with soldiers. He's finally getting around to being the education president, but I just can't figure out what was keeping him from being the education vice president for 8 years. It's not like he would have been stepping on any toes during that era. You know, not to imply that the reason the bombs are so smart is because they got all the education money. But, he did teach Saddam Hussein a lesson, I suppose.
I want to talk a little bit about your background now. I was reading a little bit about you, and apparently when you were 14, your father put you into a juvenile home. What was he worried about? What did you do?
He wanted to be alone with his new wife.
Oh, is that it?
Basically, yeah.
So what was the home like?
It was nice. It was really nice. It was wonderful. It was like a military school. It was very humane, actually. You know, I mean, we had to work in coal mines for 18 hours a day, but other than that... No, it was nice. We had our own room, you know, three meals a day. It was nicer than my own home, actually.
So it wasn't the kind of place where to straighten you out, you really ended up learning more about crime and delinquency?
That happened to most of the kids there, yeah.
And you?
Not to me, no. I was very fortunate enough to run into two people there who saw something in me that they thought might reward their efforts. And I dedicated the book to them, as a matter of fact. Those two teachers. So I was very lucky.
When you got out of the home, you didn't go back to school. You went to Canada.
Yeah, right. I just wanted to get out of the country. And also, when I got there, I found out that if you were a draft dodger, they give you free food. And even though I was only 16, I just told them I was a draft dodger. So I was posing as a coward. That's about as low as you can get, I suppose.
Well, you think draft dodgers were cowards? Is that what you're saying?
At the time, I did, yeah.
Was that an interesting political experience for you to be exposed to people who really were draft dodgers and who had given a lot of thought to the reasons why they were against the war and had, you know, uprooted themselves because of their conviction?
Well, I don't think it was because of conviction in most cases. It was because they didn't want to go into the army. And but yes, I'll tell you, the people who were helping them were very committed and really believed in what they were doing. And, of course, that's bound to have an impact on you.
So you ended up going from Canada to San Francisco. Where did you have your political awakening? Do you think of yourself as having had one?
No, I really don't. I don't really think I have an axe to grind.
Mm-hmm.
I just like to make people laugh, and if I can, to look at things with a slightly different perspective than they did before. I'm not attached to any particular perspective. And I'm always ready to change. I don't have any opinions about anything that I wouldn't change. You know, most people think war is probably the worst thing in the world. I don't know. Maybe, you know, there's things worse than that. I was trying to figure out the other day what I am against, truly, under all circumstances. One thing that I really am against. And torture, I guess, is about all. I mean, even murder sometimes is justified. And, you know, war, I mean, hopeless poverty, I think that's worse than war. I mean, I think if your, you know, country was hopelessly in poverty and with no hope of getting out, then that'd be worth fighting a war over.
How did you end up doing political comedy? Had you tried other forms of comedy?
Yeah, and I was very successful. I still do other forms of comedy. You know, it's interesting because I never wanted to do political comedy because I didn't think it was long-lasting. I wanted to develop comedy. I wanted my work to still be able to be read in a few years, you know. But I was watching The Tonight Show. It was in 1980 after the Russians had invaded Afghanistan. And Johnny Carson, who I really admire as a comedian, but he was doing this joke about it. And the punchline of the joke was he turned around and he dropped his pants. And on the back of his boxer shorts was written, "Russia sucks." And I was embarrassed for my country that this would be the level of humor in politics, political humor. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. I was afraid that a person from another country might see that and think that all Americans, that's all that they had to say. And so I resolved to try and write something and give them an alternative, you know. And I did, and 6 months later, I did it on The Tonight Show.
Do you ever have to deal with censors on Saturday Night Live?
Not anymore.
When did that end?
Oh, a year or so ago when the show started getting really scatological. Yeah, that's how we take it out. I never have had to deal with censors. And although I say things that if it were done in a sketch, the censors would have objected to it. But because I'm presenting it as my point of view, you have more latitude. You know, it's presented as separate from the show as my point of view. And so, but if they're doing it in a sketch, it's like we're endorsing that point of view.
So no one's ever told you even that you were going too far in your opinion on a political leader or president?
As a matter of fact, I did a commentary once, and I got a number of letters as well as midnight phone calls about it. And NBC, since I was gone, I was out of town, where I left town shortly thereafter, they wrote a letter and sent it to the people who wrote. And it couldn't have been written better if I had written it myself, you know, pointing out what it was really about and sticking up for me, you know, backing me up. It was about the Intifada. And some people interpreted it as being anti-Semitic when, in fact, it was anti-violence. Or, you know, they were breaking people's hands, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
For throwing rocks. And that cripples somebody for life. Can't type, can't play a musical instrument. And they bulldoze a house, you know, if they caught somebody in the house. So anyway, I was saying if they want to make an example out of these people, maybe they should try crucifixion. Because it worked for the Romans, and they thought I was saying that, you know, the Jews crucified Christ. Which I didn't. I said it worked for the Romans, you know. It was a sarcastic statement. So anyway, NBC backed me up and said, you know, that was all right. Now if they would just help me write the sketches.
Yeah. Can I get you to read another section from your new book?
I don't know. Yeah, sure, I'd love to.
Let's see, how about page 42?
I'm glad you picked this. All right, because this sums up my generation. Thank you very much. Well, as for me, I discovered acid in the summer of 68 and subsequently took enough to do chromosome damage to a Buick. For most of the winter of 68 and 69, I stumbled through a psychedelic blizzard. I became a shiftless teenage derelict, hitchhiking from dead concert to dead concert, trying to see through my hair. Through the white haze, I could make out a strange roaring sound. I was told later it was the babble of that great deaf mute of history, the silent majority, articulating its choice for president, Richard Milhouse Nixon. Most of my generation didn't have a clue what was going on. In fact, we greeted each other with the very question, "What's going on, man?" We didn't say, "Nice to see you," or "How have you been?" like people do when they have a value system that isn't crumbling in front of their eyes. No, no, we wanted to know what's happening, man. What's the deal, dude? What's the buzz? Nobody knew. The only answer I ever got was, "What it is." What it was, none of us knew. By the end of the decade, I was beginning to think the question was purely rhetorical. Well, the search for meaning came naturally to me. I grew up in a generation so starved for understanding we were able to read significance into Donovan lyrics.
So what got you to write about your teenage years and, quote, your generation?
I think the statement, you know, that we didn't know what was going on. It struck me once, that's what we used to say, what's going on? And it had to mean something more than just, you know, a greeting. Why would we greet? No one else in history has ever greeted each other by going, "I'm confused." And so I wanted to try and figure it out. Didn't, though, but I did realize that we were confused.
A. Whitney Brown gives the big picture on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. His commentaries are collected in the new book, The Big Picture. This is Fresh Air.